turns from present in the past. Every week will be an animated bash. What a cartoon! What a cartoon! Maybe a short but mostly sharp. We'll talk, we'll analyze, exploring as we go. What a cartoon!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to What a Cartoon Movie, the podcast with Jewish dinosaurs in its walls. I'm one of your hosts, the King of Cartoons, Scheming Chancellor, Bob Mackey, and this is an audio exploration of every animated movie ever. Who is here with me today, as always?
Recording from a podcast room made of fruitcake, Henry Gilbert.
And this month's episode is all about Christmas at Pee-wee's Playhouse.
I brought you a present.
It isn't a fruitcake, is it?
No. It's two fruitcakes.
Oh, well,
And yes, welcome to the special holiday edition of What a Cartoon Movie. And for this one, we really wanted to cover another hour-long animated special. And since absolutely nobody wanted to hear about Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, we're here to bring you the next best thing, or perhaps a much, much better thing, let's say. So with the release of the recent documentary Pee-wee's himself, there's never been a better time to cover one of the best modern Christmas specials out there. And by modern, I mean 37 years old, and that is the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special.
Yeah, this is, when you said it, I was like, oh, why have we never done, I never thought of that as a possibility before, even though it does also follow our animation hybrid rules for live act. Like, there are animated segments in this.
Yeah, I'd say there's about like 10 minutes of animation, but Pee-wee is a live action cartoon. It's full of puppets. We've covered puppety things on What a Cartoon before with the Muppets and everything. So it feels right to me. And this is like a foundational part of the elder millennial childhood. Perhaps late Gen Xers can fit into this as well. So it's very much within our wheelhouse on What a Cartoon movie.
I mean, how can we not include something that has the King of Cartoons in it too?
Even though most of his cartoons are bad.
Yes.
And a terrible Prince. Come on, King. Where are you getting access to these? Nowadays, a lot of these have been restored, so the King cartoons would be doing much better in the year 2025. So I want to credit Nina for this idea, my wife, because I was out with her one day, and I was like, oh, we're going to do a Christmas thing, but I want to do a special, and I'm not sure which one we should cover. And just immediately she says, just do the Pee-wee special. And I said, honey, I could kiss you. But we promise no kissing until at least year five of marriage. So I'm still waiting for that. That's going to be coming in January. I'll get a kiss then.
Nina built a whole mistletoe headpiece just to try and get you ahead of that, but couldn't do it.
She's this condo's Missy Vaughn.
No, yeah. Thank you, Nina, for that perfect suggestion. It makes so much sense once you say it.
And there's perfect timing on this podcast because when it launches on Patreon, and I believe this will already have happened when it's on the free feed, we are just a few days away from the Criterion 4K release of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I have a copy ordered. I rarely buy those big, expensive Criterion 4Ks, but this one is just too special for me. So that is coming in the mail.
I think it has like many new extras, as Criterion always does, including, I swear I saw it said, there's like a new commentary with Tim Burton, or maybe it's an old one, but it at the very least has a couple commentaries on it.
Yeah, the ancient commentary from the year 1999 or 2000 DVD, the one I still own, has Rubens and Tim Burton on it, and it's the only good Tim Burton documentary because he has to talk to someone else.
That's good. It's the one friend he'll trust being around, I guess. Though, well, yeah. Though then again, it seemed like they had some making up to do, but they eventually did make up, not to get ahead of history.
Yeah, and yeah, I think I said this before, but every solo Tim Burton commentary is so disappointing because every, I don't know, 8 minutes, he'll just be like, Johnny's really funny in this scene. And then you won't hear him again for a very long time. And you're like, did I turn off the commentary? No, Tim Burton's still here. He just has not a lot to say. He's not a very, he's more of an introvert. He's taken the online test.
I'm surprised. I would think he'd be such an outgoing guy, that Tim Burton. He'd love talking to people and telling stories.
And this is a special warning for listeners on the free feed or perhaps the $5 feed at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. At some point, this history will shut off completely, but there is many more hours to be found on the Patreon if you're on the $10 level. So if you want to hear the rest of the podcast, which includes an entire discussion of this Christmas special and the rest of the history, you have to go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up for the $10 level. You get access to the rest of this podcast and also 7 complete years of What a Cartoon Movie. And if you like hearing about Christmas specials, we have covered things like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, The Muppet Christmas Carol, 8 Crazy Nights, and The Nightmare Before Christmas. So if you've signed up immediately, you can listen to very, very, very long podcasts about all these classic holiday specials and movies.
Oh, and Tokyo Godfathers. I bet all of those would cover everything you listen to for the waking hours of Christmas and Boxing Day, at the very least.
Yeah, Tokyo Godfathers is a Christmas and a New Year's movie, so you can cover those in just one movie. Very efficient.
Oh, and don't forget, too, that if you sign up there, you get the $5 a month stuff where we cover, you get early and ad-free access to the What a Cartoon podcast, plus Talk King of the Hill, Talking Futurama, and all of the other miniseries we've done to date. So you get a ton of stuff.
Yes, again, that is patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, and you can hear the rest of this podcast and many, many, many others. I think at this point, close to 300 bonus podcasts, including the movies. There's a lot there. So to kick things off, Henry, I want to know, what is your history with the Pee Wee Herman character and Paul Reubens?
Yeah, as a kid, I had an innocent childhood-like love of his work. Like, I really, I think, I want to say it would have been like 87 or so, where Pee Wee's Big Adventure was taped off of HBO, and I watched it all the time, like on repeat. I know my mom took us to see Big Top Pee Wee in theaters, and we were regular viewers of the TV show. And I feel certain that I watched this live as well. And I think, too, that it was something I could really share with my mom, much like watching the Batman Adam West show, that they were super campy childhood throwbacks for her. But for me, I just viewed them as like, oh, this is, I saw them devoid of camp. I was just like, well, Pee Wee's just a fun guy who does fun things.
You didn't know about mid-century modern Americana yet?
Not yet. I hadn't taken those classes yet. And I mean, also, too, we went through, like, you know, the downfall of Pee Wee that confused me as well as a, like, 9-year-old and when it happened, almost 10. And so, yeah, it was just like, you know, he was then realizing, you know, more and more about him as time goes on and viewing him as a camp, amazing performer, and then to know all of his connections to everybody else, and also slowly recognizing all the people who are in this special, I came to love it so much more.
Yeah, I have a very similar story because Pee-wee's Playhouse started airing when I was 4 years old, so this is the perfect time for it to start warping my brain. And I especially remember adults, especially my mom, really loving Pee-wee. So that was just like the checkered flag saying, this is cool, adults like it too, you're kind of grown up for watching it. And the show absolutely fostered my love for kitschy mid-century Americana and the related aesthetic. It's nostalgia for a time I wasn't even alive, but I love everything with this vibe. And I'm pretty sure it all starts with Pee-wee. It has to, because so much would follow from this kind of aesthetic through the 90s up to Y2K.
I mean, the connections are all over the place, let alone like the stylistic look of it fits so much with just the same, even The Simpsons. The Simpsons comes from the same place. Matt Groening and Gary Panter, like, they're all friends. Like, they all came from the same kitschy generation. And, like, Pee-wee is basically, like, or Paul Reubens was the age of our parents, basically. Like, of our moms, like, they have the same references. When my mom saw Frankie and Annette on this, she liked it for the same reason, like, Pee-wee put them in the special, too, because they were fans growing up.
Now, here's the thing. On this special, on this podcast, rather, we are going to be the old people explaining who these now dead celebrities are. The notes took a very long time because I have to give little bios on, like, who was Zsa Zsa Gabor? Well, I know who she was, but nobody remembers her slapping that traffic cop unless you watch The Naked Gun 2.5, right, because they'll make a joke about it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's well, and we're just giving back because I definitely recall watching this and having several of the people, like my mom, explain why it was funny or why she thought these characters, I'll name them when we get to each of them, but my mom explaining them to me was half of the fun of watching the special back when it aired.
So yeah, Pee-wee's Playhouse is one of my earliest favorite things. I remember for Christmas of 89, I got an official Pee-wee's Playhouse sweater with the great Gary Panter art. This is what you get your child if you are a single mother raising two children while living with your mother. You don't get him the Playhouse playset or the action figures. You get him a practical sweater. But you know what? I love that sweater. And my opinion on it was, this is my fancy sweater. I'm going to wear it to special occasions. And I did for about 2 or 3 years before the troubles started. Maybe 2 years I got out of that sweater before the troubles started. And Pee-wee was not a such a fun thing to talk about for a while.
Yeah, I definitely had at least the Pee-wee action figure, and I feel like I had a cherry, I want to say, because I remember going through my old action figures at home later in life and being like, oh man, I lost the jacket for Pee-wee. Like, it was accessories were lost on my Pee-wee action figure.
Was it the big talking action figure, or was it the little like regular G.I. Joe size?
Yeah, it was
guy.
The G.I. Joe sized one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the difference between you and I, Henry. I, at first, did not like Pee-wee's Big Adventure because my mind could not handle how it had a different canon. The house he lived in was boring. Who are all these humans he's interacting with? Where's Miss Yvonne? Where are the puppets? When I became a teenager, I eventually started loving the movie. Of course, it's coming to me on Criterion 4K. It was one of the first DVDs I ever bought. I like the movie now, but my brain could not handle how there are different like Pee-wee multiverses in which, oh, he's a farmer in this one, and he owns a house in this one, and the playhouse exists in the other one. Maybe the playhouse is just where he goes on Saturdays, and he's a farmer some of the time and a homeowner the other part of the time. I don't know. But to make a long story short here, I was a big fan of Pee-wee up through the end of his first chapter. And yes, when the troubles happened, I was making the same jokes everyone else did because I was watching In Living Color and SNL and everything else. But I was also kind of secretly rooting for him throughout the 90s. Like, oh, he's in Batman Returns as the Penguin's dad. And oh, he's a voice in Nightmare Before Christmas. And you're watching the rise of Pee-wee happen throughout the 90s. And I definitely enjoyed the Pee-wee renaissance of the 2010s. And I will say one key element of falling back in love with Pee-wee. I'm not sure if you're around for this, Henry, but from 2006 to 2007, Adult Swim aired all of Pee-wee's Playhouse from front to back, and I watched all of it. And Pee-wee's Playhouse was a constant topic of conversation between me and my friends, the things that happened on the show last night. It's like I was between the ages of 4 and 9 again.
Oh, man, I totally miss that, because that was when I had just moved to Berkeley and was living on my own for the first time. So I had internet, but no cable. Like, I was watching New Venture Brothers via like the web portal for Adult Swim. So I was not watching regular Adult Swim at the time. So I missed out.
Well, I was living in my childhood bedroom watching Pee-wee's Playhouse again, but you know, having some beers during it. So it was a different experience.
Yeah, I definitely remember when it came back around, or I think it was the early aughts when I finally saw the HBO special, the original one, and that opened my eyes as well. Because when he was making his 90s comeback, when I saw him, he had multiple guest appearances on Murphy Brown, and they were celebrated. I think he even got Emmy nominated, but it was celebrated. It was like, oh, wow, Paul Reubens is back. We judged him too much, and he's so funny in this. And it was him proving himself. That was me thinking, now a child entertainer is making adult things. I didn't think it meant that he was just continuing the same work he had been doing.
Yes, I was also a 11-year-old viewer of Murphy Brown.
Yes,
rooting for Paul Reubens in this role as I guess the joke on Murphy Brown is she went through a lot of secretaries. He was the one who stuck around because he was so demented.
Yes, yeah, he even had like this whole speech about like, I swear it was some monologue about, oh, you know, you do all of these things and you think people forget, but they never forget. They never forget the mistakes you make.
Well, his ultimate comeback was saying, heard any good jokes lately on what the MTV Movie Awards, and he got a standing ovation. So it feels like there was so much love for Pee-wee that he bounced back from the unfortunate events of July 1991 pretty quickly.
I think so, at least as for an adult audience. For kids, it felt, yeah.
The Pee-wee character was poisoned for a while, and then we got to the Renaissance eventually. But let's go back to the beginning with the beginning of Paul Reubens, or should I say Paul Reubenfeld, because he is a Jewish man, but he adopted a stage name, which was the style at the time, and I'm sure it still is in many cases.
Yeah, you still hear about it even to this day. I think people change their names a little less, or they're better at hiding their secret uncool names. Like, but he's right up there with Jennifer Anastanopoulos, or I think that was it.
Yeah, I think like Natalie Portman's name is like Natalie Hirschlag.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's it's not just Jewish, but it actors, but it is. I mean, for Pee-wee or for Paul growing up, I get it. And he had many things he felt he needed to hide in life, I think.
And I just want to note a few things up front before we get into the history of Paul Reubens. So we're going to cover his history and Pee-wee up through his Christmas special and the end of the character's first era. So we may touch upon some things that happened afterwards. We already have, but we don't have time to go over all 70 years of his life. So I would ask you to not say, I can't believe you forgot to mention this, or I'm surprised you didn't mention. If you have any additional trivia to offer, please just say, here's another fun fact, with a colon and a little smiley face at the end. That's all I'm asking. And I will also say the primary document for this episode is the 2025 documentary Pee-wee Asks Himself. This is the definitive documentary about the very private Paul Reubens, and one he only participated in because he knew he was dying and also kept that a secret from the documentarian. So I have no other option but to crib from this entirely. So please find a way to watch it, even if you don't have access to HBO Max. I don't, but I found a way to watch it. It's called the internet. So it's essential. It is so good. And the documentary has a narrative itself, which is fascinating.
Yeah, I wish it was five times as long. Yeah, but it's a 4-hour documentary. It covers so much. It talks to so many people. Like, there's a sadness to it because Paul Reubens clearly always wanted to control his own narrative. And he is, in Pee-wee fashion, cheekily fighting with the camera / the director of like, oh, is this the truth? I don't know. Like at times, and because he is a little bothered, he's not in charge of it as the director. But I think it is better having been made by somebody else.
And when you get to his two public disgraces, sitting down to watch the documentary, I thought, now we're going to hear his side of the story. He does not want to talk about those things. So if you're looking for dirt on Paul Reubens, you're not going to find it. You're going to find a very fleshed out story about his life and just so much footage of how prevalent the Pee-wee character was throughout the 80s. It wasn't just a couple of movies and a show. He was making all of these appearances. There was a stage show. We'll talk about all of these things, but the documentary is so good, and I wish it was a little more available.
Yes, yeah, I hope it gets a physical release and maybe with some even deleted scenes. But as it is, it also is a perfect, memoir for him because it's full of his gigantic collection of archival materials of his career, too.
And hopefully we'll see more of those as the years go on. There has to be so much footage. There needs to be like a Pee-wee archive we can visit online or something like that, or the Paul Reubens Museum, perhaps.
Yes.
But you're going to see just how much he worked.
No, it's incredible how much he saved. Like, he probably has the only foot. Like, he talks about how he was one of the first owners of a VHS. So there's probably like hundreds of hours of footage that only he bothered archiving of like early cable. Like, not just his own self, but just tons of interviews in there. It's incredible.
So yes, I hope there are Pee-wee archivists out there working through that massive store of content. So Paul Reubens, born August 27th, 1952. We don't have to go over all the elements of his early life, but we can cover some of the things that shaped him. So yes, he grew up in a Jewish family. So Jewish, in fact, that his father, Milton, was one of the founding members of the Israeli army. So it's important to remember when you're looking at current events, Israel is not much older than Pee-wee Herman, or excuse me, Paul Reubens.
Yes, Paul Reubens and Israel, about the same age. That's funny.
And you know what? I just rewatched the Pee-wee stage show from the early 80s. There is a joke about Israel, which I thought was very funny, because he's reading letters from around the world from his fans. And it's a letter from Shlomo from Israel. And he's like, my name is Shlomo. I am 9 years old. I have been in the Israel army for 2 years.
That's a good joke. That's a good joke.
Just a little joke about how militarized Israel has always been.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also, if you can put on your pants correctly, you'll become a general by 23.
They let Gal Gadot be a sniper.
Oh, God. Good times.
Yes.
Good times.
This is related to what we're talking about. So initially, the family lived in what I would call central New York. But like many Jewish families of the era, and I assume now, they soon relocated to Florida. Sarasota, to be specific. And the Reubenfelds fostered the creativity of Paul and his two siblings, but everything really started to click for Paul Reubens once he moved down south. So one big factor that shaped him was the circus, because Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus had their winter headquarters in Sarasota, Florida, and while Paul would put on little plays at home via a stage his father built in the basement, this really unlocked the love of performing for him, both the basement stage plays and having such access to the circus. He went to circus camp, I believe. Yeah. That's another thing that really unlocked his abilities and his desire to perform. And you can see his fascination with the circus in the bad movie Big Top Pee Wee, which is his blank check. And that actually hit theaters 5 months before this Christmas special. The Christmas special is the rallying everyone together after the utter failure of the Pee Wee Herman movie sequel.
Yeah, I have to say, when I saw Big Top Pee Wee in theaters, that was the one time I saw it. And I don't think I ever asked to watch it in full again as a kid, I think.
Yes, it was a rude awakening as a kid. It's one of those times where for the first time in your life, you're realize a movie can be bad because it comes on HBO. Living with my grandma, she has HBO. I'm like, okay, new Pee-wee movie, cool, I love Pee-wee. You sit down to watch and you're like, well, Pee-wee's not funny, what's happening? And then I rewatched the movie as an adult just last week and I'm thinking, did I ever make it to the end of this film? I don't think I did.
Wow.
It's so dull. It's surprisingly dull for a Pee-wee movie. And guys, Pee-wee is extremely hetero in this movie, and he is an extreme pervert. He is jumping on women, and the centerpiece of the film is like a 2.5-minute makeout scene he has with the woman from Rain Man and Hot Shots, the Italian actress.
I recall being in an empty $2 movie theater with my mom took us to cheap afternoon movies that day, as I recall, to see Big Top Pee Wee. And yeah, it was rough, but his love of the circus is very fun to me. Like all the circus was like based in Florida. Like that also just seems incredible. And I say this as a Floridian, it's very Florida. It's like, oh yeah, the circus is based here. We keep all the animals here when we're not on tour, and we're going to train children in how to like tightrope walk and juggle.
The laws against, you know, child cruelty and animal abuse and clown abuse are much lighter here.
Unions too. It's a right to work state. Yeah.
Well, thankfully, now the circus is dead unless you're French-Canadian. It's thriving if you're like the Cirque du Soleil.
I heard a story of somebody going to like the Ringling Brothers is still doing it, but they got rid of all the animals for good reason, for animal cruelty sake. But it's like, well, now you got nothing. Like now, well, you got clowns and trapeze and stuff.
You just routed up all the clowns in one location. You're telling me to avoid this spot entirely. I don't want this. So, to put it lightly, Paul Rubens, a big theater kid. He'd soon become a really avant-garde theater kid in his college years. But even before college, he was racking up a lot of local roles, plenty of acclaim. So, the acting and performing bug bites him early. And from a very early age, he is out there on the stage, making people laugh, making people cry, doing all kinds of great stuff. So, he attends a few New England universities. And this is when he starts looking for an acting school that will match his kind of weird, kooky vibe. So he is turned down by both Juilliard and Carnegie Mellon University. And then he gets accepted to CalArts.
Whoa.
Yes, CalArts is coming up on a non-animation related podcast, even though there's some animation. So it's not just all the Beanmouth Army. It is also Paul Rubens. And by the way, I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek about that. I think we've all stopped complaining about that online.
Yeah, I think the reactionaries have moved on to a different thing to complain about now. But it's, you forget the CalArts isn't just the recruiting ground for Disney Animation and others, but it also has non-animation departments as well. And though to see the stuff that Rubens was working on then, it would make Walt Disney faint at the sight of it.
Yes, and he was worried about these things getting out when he became Pee-wee and became a big success with that character. So if you watch Pee-wee as himself, you can see all of these weird experimental films he was doing, very queer films as well, in this world of avant-garde film and theater. And he had some very notable classmates. So with him in the CalArts class of 73, we have Katie Sagal, Leela herself, Michael Richards, a.k.a. Kramer, and David Hasselhoff, the guy from Knight Rider and later Baywatch. So CalArts, they're a good talent farm, let's say, not just for animators.
That was incredible to see that he was coming up with David Hasselhoff and Katie Sagal. Like to see David Hasselhoff like on old VHS footage, like or camcorder footage, acting as early 20s was amazing. And now I only want to ask Katie Sagal about that. Like, wait, you knew Paul Rubens in college? Like you worked with him then? It's incredible.
So Paul Rubens eventually finds the acting troupe, the improv troupe that will determine his future. So he is, after this, set free into the world, the very sleazy world of mid-70s Hollywood. So what is a weirdo like him to do? Of course, stand-up is on the verge of becoming a boom, so he finds plenty of work in comedy clubs doing various characters. But there's no YouTube or TikTok, so he zeroes in on the one outlet that allows a performer like him to be a total freak in front of millions of people, and that, my friends, is The Gong Show.
Yes. It was the YouTube of its day. It was the TikTok of its day. It's where Homer and Barney got three gongs.
Yes, Pee-wee got a lot more gongs than that breakdancing robot that caught on fire.
Which I guess is technically Clonky. That's not or Clonky's cousin, maybe.
Henry, I got to stop you right here. It's Conky.
Conky. La-la.
This is going to be a Yosemite Sam thing, and I got to nip it in the bud.
Okay, Conky.
Yeah. Yes. You can see some of this footage in the doc. So he would make 14 appearances on The Gong Show. Pee-wee did not originate here, but another character did. Thankfully, one that did not catch on. It is the Native American lounge singer, Jay Longtoe. And yes, Rubens admits this was very racist. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, Paul did not carry Jay Longtoe into the Pee-wee verse. By the way, I was thinking of the Mystery Science Theater movie character, Johnny Longbone.
Oh, yes.
From I Believe
right.
It Lives by Night. He was describing a very complex stew recipe in that movie.
Yeah, I'm glad in the doc that Pee-wee isn't trying to make any apologies for it. He's like, it was a long time ago, and it was like, oh, everybody was like it. He also grew up on F Troops, you know, terrible comedy also about Native Americans. But for him, you know, late in life to be like, you know what, it just is racist. Like, and I'm glad I didn't do it, and I feel bad about it.
I mean, he was born in 52, one of the first boomers to grow up with television. He was very much part of the Cowboys and Indians generation, you know?
Oh, sure, yeah. And Bob put quotes around that, listeners. He did. He put the...
Oh, I did? Oh, yes.
Yes, yeah. He,
Cowboys and Indigenous people. Well, they didn't call him that then.
Yeah, I think... I do think that's a huge part of Pee-wee, too, that made him attractive to, like, nerds like us, as well as that... He was, you know, it is the phrase, but like raised by TV. Like he is clearly a kid who watched endless television, like which was where like you'd see countless reruns of Little Rascals and the Three Stooges, all of these things that just filled the airway or old campy horror films. That was his diet.
Laurel and Hardy, silent movies, just all of the filler that now is recognized as, oh, these are classics, this is art. But then it was like, here's a bunch of cheap crap you can show kids to fill time.
Yeah, just don't call it Our Gang anymore. Call it Little Rascals. And who cares if what objectionable material there may be in it.
So around this time, he discovers the Groundlings, which is the now famous improvisational team, a comedy team. And this really must have been right around the time the Groundlings were formed, because the Groundlings begins in 1974. Paul gets out of CalArts in 73, kicks around LA for a bit. So they were a very new operation at the time.
Yeah, to hear Lorraine Newman in it speak about the founding of it and how like that's why she was so young. Joining Saturday Night Live, like she had already made a name for herself in the Groundlings in LA with her sister and others. And it's like, yeah, to think of when that type of improv was really getting started. And when you see the list of names from the Groundlings, like it's stunning every time I see it. I'm like, oh, that's why it's just like how we know a ton of comedy people from our generation who like, well, they all knew each other in one of two UCB studios, the Upright Citizens Brigade studios on either coast 20 years ago.
Yeah, I feel like before UCB, whenever you saw an SNL person or a sketch comedy person, it was always either Groundlings or Second City.
Yep. Yeah. One of those two. And it would be Second City Chicago or Second City Toronto. Mm-hmm. It'd be one of those two.
So Paul gets a whiff of the Groundlings and he realizes, I not only want to be a part of this, I want to be the leader of the pack. And he is not shy about admitting this. He is a very competitive guy, kind of a selfish guy. He is a striver, and he holds a lot of grudges. And you can tell in the doc that he has pushed a lot of people away. So to become Pee-wee, he needed to let everyone know, I am the most talented one here, and you all need to support me, and maybe there'll be a place for you, maybe there won't be.
Yeah, I mean, in the documentary, he talks about like pulling focus. Like, I can pull focus with the best of them. I mean, eventually the Groundlings just became literally the Pee-wee Herman show. Like, that's his intention. And I think that comes through later in the character of Pee-wee. Like, as seen in this special, Pee-wee can be a selfish guy. Mm-hmm. People will tell him, will even say like kind of sarcastic things to him, and he doesn't get that they're saying like, Pee-wee, aren't you being a little selfish? He doesn't even get it because he's just very focused on himself.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of Pee-wee's selfishness comes from Paul Reubens' own id, and he is both making fun of himself and sort of getting what he wants through a character.
Yeah, I think so too. It lets him, I mean, to know that he was invented through an improv character, like improv is a game, and if you create a character who like wins scenarios by being like the kind of the Bugs Bunny of the scene, that also does, on a psychological level, you do get to take over through the expression of the story. Like, so not to be an armchair psychologist to Paul Reubens and his character.
So there have been a ton of famous groundlings over the years. We don't need to name them all here, but Paul's particular crew featured Edie McClurg, John Paragon, and perhaps most importantly, Phil Hartman, although John Paragon, very important to the Pee-wee operation. And yes, these two guys are absolutely key to the formation of Pee-wee Herman, the surrounding universe of characters, the movies, but we'll talk more about them later because I love this being the first stage of Phil Hartman's career that still feels like a fun fact to me.
Yes.
He helped create Pee-wee Herman and wrote the first movie and was Captain Carl for, I want to say like 6 years, 5 years of like time in our universe. He was only on the TV show for one season, but he was a collaborator with Paul Reubens for like half of the decade.
Yeah, if we were slightly older fans and born a little earlier, we would have been like how we were with Weezer, of like, oh, you know, it's Rivers Cuomo isn't as good without Matt
Sharp.
Matt Sharp, thank you, Bob. Without Matt Sharp, he's not as good. But meanwhile, new Weezer fans are just like, what? It's just awesome. It's just Rivers Cuomo is the guy. We might have been that same way with Phil Hartman leaving it.
It's just a 57-year-old man writing songs about malls. What's not to like?
I liked it better when he was a 38-year-old man writing songs about being a virgin.
Yeah, that's the era I prefer. So other people that were part of the crew later were Cassandra Peterson, a.k.a. Elvira. She joined in 79, but she's part of the mix. She's in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. She's a talking head on the documentary. There's a lot of crossover there because, you know, Paul Reubens, his sexuality is very complicated, I'll say. We'll get into that at some point. But I can tell he loves women with big breasts based on the Miss Yvonne character and his connection with Cassandra Peterson.
Yes, I mean, it's fun to see Cassandra Peterson in it. I mean, okay, we'll get into it more later, but I definitely felt in the doc, multiple of the women who are speaking, they had the feel of the straight girls in theater class who fell in love with their gay co-stars and who were like, were very close with their gay co-stars and were like, oh, if only they weren't gay, kind of. Like, one woman literally says, I think it's Lorraine Newman's sister, says that about John Paragon. She's like, oh, if he wasn't gay, we'd have been in love. Or like, Cassandra is, or Peterson herself also is not straight either, so I don't want to call her a straight lady, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Pee-wee and Paul, very private, and it's really hard to figure out because you have women in the documentary saying, I was basically his girlfriend, we don't hear about any kind of like sexual or romantic relationships outside of the one he was with a man early on in his life, in his college years. But then you see his dream project, which is Pig.Pee-wee, and Pee-wee is the straightest you've ever seen him. And he has complete creative control over the entire project. He could have done whatever he wanted to with that film, but he decided Pee-wee will be straight. He will be kissing women. He loves women. He will be making out with one of the most attractive young actresses in Hollywood currently. It is complicated, I'll say.
Yeah, I would say it's complicated too. I also, with Cassandra Peterson, it's so great seeing her. I wish she was in the doc more, though she's done many interviews. You can find Elvira interviews all over the place. I just watched a great one with her with the drag queen Trixie Mattel. It was really good. Mm. But Cassandra Peterson in the doc, her talking about how like, oh, every Thanksgiving, and I, when watching it during Thanksgiving, it made me feel a little sad. She said like, oh, yeah, every Thanksgiving, it was me and Paul and Phil and John. And I was like, oh man, she's the only one left. That's, it made me feel sad.
Well, I did my due diligence of playing all the Elvira pinball games while in Portland this fall. So that's my annual like pilgrimage to Elvira is playing all three of her pinball games. So we've covered the early life of Paul Reubens, his rise in fame, at least locally, his college life, his finding the groundlings. Now let's talk about the origins of the Pee-wee Herman character. So the creation of Pee-wee Herman is complicated. Many elements went into the configuration of this character. So The earliest roots of Pee-wee can be traced back to a 1978 improv exercise in which Paul played a comic who completely failed at any joke he attempted. And the famous Pee-wee voice originated from when Paul was cast in a 1970 performance of the 1939 play Life with Father. So he needed a particularly irritating way of speaking to play an annoying character. So the Pee-wee voice really came into being here. So that's just one element. And sidebar here, a very fascinating thing about the Pee-wee performance that I've noticed studying it carefully is that there is no one Pee-wee voice. Ruben cycles between what I would call 3.5 different voices while doing the Pee-wee character. And there's no rhyme or reason to that, like exterior in terms of the people watching it. But in his mind, we know I'm going to do this Pee-wee voice for this line and this Pee-wee voice for that line. So he is a hard character to imitate because there are 3.5 distinct modes of that voice. And if you watch the Pee-wee Herman show, the original stage show that's been recorded, he is basically only using one of the voices, and it feels a little off. He would become a much more complicated performance a little bit later in history.
Yeah, I think that it's why he's a really hard one to imitate. If you don't, you might just get stuck in the childish voice or the "I know you are, but what am I?" Like those, that was more Yoda, but you know what I mean.
You are, I know.
Pee-wee did teach kids a lot of good, like, childhood insults to give to each other. Like, I don't make garbage. I just throw it out. Or, you know, all the best insults.
Yes, I know you are, but what am I? Classic kid comeback. I like how he's just, like, reinterpreting child street jokes through this adult man-child character. But it gave all of us elder millennials a lot of ammo to use on the playground, all of these, like, retreads of late 50s, early 60s comebacks.
Mm-hmm. Just like Bart Simpson would do for us, too. It follows for me. Simpsons, Pee-wee to Simpsons is a straight line to me.
Mm-hmm. And the name Pee-wee came from a brand of harmonica that Rubens owned as a boy. And Herman is from his childhood. It was the last name of what he calls a very crazy, high-powered kid he knew in Florida. But it just seemed to flow so naturally. Pee-wee Herman. So that is the origin of the name. And in terms of how he's dressed, the famous gray suit, at least the first one, came from Groundlings founder Gary Austin. And the red bow tie has vague, uninteresting origins, and that someone just handed it to him before a performance saying, this would be funny, having a little red bow tie. So many things went into this. But also, John Paragon and Phil Hartman are also contributing writers who are working with Pee-wee to inform this character.
Yeah, I think, I mean, with improv scenes, you're watching them be built live in front of you. So there's probably many different pieces to it that can never be, like, who told him to put Tootsie Rolls in his pockets or whatever. Also, I think I was glad in the doc they show a little bit of how Robin Williams and Andy Kaufman are much in the air then and inspiring everybody. Like the Pee-wee in the stand-up version reminded me a lot of like Andy Kaufman's embattled stand-up characters on stage too. A little more innocent.
Yeah, like alienating the audience or giving them a performance they're not going to expect, you know, playing with the idea of the performance. These are all in the air and inspiring comedians all over the place. So we all know who Phil Hartman is. We can talk a bit more about him soon, but I do want to cover John Paragon. So John Paragon passed away in 2021. He'd remained tight with Rubens throughout the Playhouse era. He plays both Jambi, the genie, and Terry, the sweet little tattletale dinosaur. And he's had a lot of roles over the years. You can find him as an actor in a lot of things. But I think I remember him most as the dimwit son of the Kevin McCarthy character in UHF.
Right. God. He's great in that. He's also one of the gay bullies in Seinfeld who bullies
yes.
Kramer, too. Yeah.
He's a very funny performer. He got a lot of work. He has passed away. This, by the way, this special is a real graveyard.
Yes.
So I hope you brought flowers to this podcast to lay on the many tombstones of the people we're talking about.
Yeah, I just watched for the first time this year the cult movie Eating Raoul, and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, that's Jambi running this porno store in the movie. And it was like very funny to see him in there too. But yeah, that is like the more of the queer soul added. But then you have an aggressively heterosexual Phil Hartman in there too.
Yes.
In the mix.
And if you watch the original stage show, you can clearly see, well, yeah, John Paragon and Paul Rubens and Phil Hartman are the standouts here. There's a reason why they continued on with such big careers. Of course, Edie McClurg is great and the others are great. Lin-Marie Stewart is great. But honestly, Phil Hartman at that point is the strongest performer as Captain Carl in that stage show. He is just blowing everybody out of the water. He's screaming at the top of his lungs in every scene. And like I said earlier, it's fascinating to me that this was the first part of his career, and it's something I only learned about in the 90s, just being way into SNL and Phil Hartman and realizing, oh, shit, he was Captain Carl. Like, and then looking at the credits of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, he is one of the writers on this movie. It's like it was a secret kept for me, but everybody of a certain age probably knew this.
Yeah, yeah, it's how it goes. Like, I think we're seeing that now in our 40s, like people realizing that, wow, Jack Black was on Mr. Show a million years ago. Like, now that Jack Black is like the most famous child movie star in the world now, apparently.
Yes, Jack Black is doing what he did 25 years ago. We were there.
Yeah, it's great. To explain to kids what Tenacious D is before, of course, Kyle had to ruin it all with his disgusting joke. Ooh.
Well, you know, Jack Black bouncing back. He's going to be in everything until people get sick of him again.
How many silly songs are going to get in the next Mario Galaxy movie are going to get like 800 million views on YouTube from children?
You know, I love Mario Galaxy. I'm playing the remaster right now. That's still an odd choice to me. It's like, we made the Mario Brothers movie. What's next? We're going to make a movie based on the 18-year-old game. All right, sure. I guess at this point it'll be 19 years old.
Yeah, I feel like partially it's to get away from calling it 2, like having a number in it, because it's still not what you're supposed to do. But also, like, watching the trailer, I had forgotten that. I was like, oh man, what kind of celebrity is going to voice the Lumas? And I remember like, oh wait, there was a Luma in the first movie, and the joke is it's a little kid saying weird stuff. And so that's sadly how all the Lumas are going to sound. It's the one joke. Like,
I forgot the Lumas were included. Well, I will have to see that out of weary obligation as a podcaster for my video game podcast. So I look forward to my take on that. I just really hope they don't use as much licensed music.
Yeah, please. They wrote a good soundtrack originally for it. We don't need to hear I Need a Hero for the 80th time. But
or Take on Me.
I'll be there in the theaters as well, Bob, if you need another soldier.
So, yes, Phil Hartman instrumental to this whole project as a writer and a performer. And I just want to note that we're not going to be talking much about Big Adventure here because we only have so much time, and I feel like it's a likely candidate for a live-action What a Cartoon Movie episode, so stay tuned for that, perhaps. But yes, Big Adventure came before Playhouse, so this first Tim Burton film was mainstream America's true introduction to the character. We'll talk about the many appearances, but this is the first time that Pee-wee was saying, hello, I am in a movie that's playing at your multiplex, you don't know who I am, but I've been around for a while, come check out my world.
And I love the connection that Shelley Long made the connection for them. That was a great story, too.
But oh, Shelley Duvall.
Shelley Duvall.
Because
Shelley
she Duvall. Was in Frankenweenie, the good version, the old short.
I'm whiffing on names today. Apologies, listeners. But and seeing in the doc, too, like the tour he did, like the sold out crowds. But it also could see, like, he was starting to get so mainstream from all his appearances, like the crowds at his concert venues. They knew where the jokes were coming. He's like, like they were like, oh boy, like the excitement of him doing the Scotch tape bit was buzzing before he even said it. Like they all knew it was coming.
You piled into the car just to see that. Well, that is getting a little ahead of ourselves. We're still at the beginning of Pee-wee. We're going to trace his ascent. So the Pee-wee character is created. And at this point, Paul Rubens is trying to get on SNL. Because that's where you kind of go. You kind of graduate from your local performances to the one sketch show on television. But Gilbert Gottfried hired instead for a disastrous season. Paul Rubens lucky he did not get on SNL that year. So he did what many podcasters do, perhaps the two guys you're listening to. They fuel their resentments and hatred of the world and their enemies into a creative project that ends up being very successful. And one that would be the basis of Pee-wee's Playhouse. So we don't have a TV show yet, but this is what Paul does with his resentment, with the feelings of failure. I'm going to make something that succeeds, damn it. And this is where the Pee-wee stage show begins.
I mean, he really lucked out there in that, like, one, Gilbert Gottfried was like one of the most hated members of that cast, and he had a horrible time, and just about everybody got fired. There's also a documentary about that season on Peacock that I watched. It was really good. George Meyer actually is a talking head in it. So by Pee-wee not being on it, like, he got to own his character more too. Like, if at that point in the Pee-wee character, if he had become an SNL character, then Lorne would have had his hooks in him, you know? Mm-hmm.
Instead, he would appear as Pee-wee later as a wholly independent owned character by himself.
Thank you.